Can everybody hear me? Just make sure that my...
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, perfect. If I fade in and out, it's probably because my broadband in the morning seems to have issues. So if I really have issues, then I might switch to my phone and see how that works or switch off my video. So just let me know if I have problems, because if I switch off my video, it seems to be doing better. So let me get started. Before I get started, any questions about this week? Because this is, of course, the week where the blank hits the fan. So you've got your project due, your final exam in a week and 4 days. So expect to hear from me even more than you heard from me in the past. I mean, if you thought I was nagging you before, I'm going to nag you even more this week. But a lot of things are going to come to fruition. So any questions before we start? Perry?
No, sorry, I just had this
one. Okay. So let me pick up where I left off last session. We were talking about dividends. And if you remember, I set up a framework for dividends. And I said there are two basic questions you need to start with. One is, how much has my company returned to investors in the form of dividends and buybacks? And the second is, how much could it have returned? Now, the second question sounds incredibly messy and difficult to answer, but it's actually a very straightforward question. It's based upon cash in and cash out. Cash in what sense? What you get is cash from operations, net income plus depreciation, cash out being CapEx, working capital, debt payments. It's what's left in the till at the end of the year. We called it free cash flow equity, but it's just a fancy word for cash left over after every other need has been met. So I said, compare what's returned to what could have been returned. One of two things is going to be true. Either your company has a cash surplus, it's building up a cash balance, or it's paying out more than it can. Then I said, ask a follow-up question. Do you trust the managers of this company with your cash? And here's why that matters. If you have a company that you think has good projects, so let's say you're in this box, you're going to give managers complete flexibility in accumulating your cash. Why? Because you're hoping that they will spend your cash wisely. That's why when you see a company like Google accumulate cash, you don't see investors putting up a hue and a cry about, hey, give me the cash back. In contrast, if you're a company with a history of taking bad investments, of delivering bad returns to your stockholders, expect pressure to build up on you. Whether that pressure pays off or not will depend on how good corporate governance is. In the US, these are the companies that the Carl Icahns and the activist investors target because they want cash to be returned. Now, if you're returning too much in cash, again, I'm going to ask you, how good are your projects? If you have good projects and you're returning too much in cash, you're doing double damage to yourself. Why? Because when you pay too much in cash, you're turning away good projects. You're making your company less valuable. So when you have a cash deficit, you're returning too much in cash. My push to you is, hey, return less in cash. Whether that's dividends or buybacks, return less in cash. And finally, you have the worst possible scenario. These are companies and bad businesses that are returning too much in cash. And the reason they're difficult to deal with is you don't know where to start. Because if you ask this company to cut dividends, you're very quickly going to set yourself up to a follow-up problem. They're going to cut the dividends, take the cash, and invest the cash in bad projects. So what I'd like you to think about is where in this matrix your company falls. And as you look at the choices, you're going to see very quickly that the way you deal with cash and dividends is very different for different companies. Now, last session, I talked about Microsoft accumulating cash in the late 90s and how it got there, right? Every year it held back the free cash flow equity, paid no dividends, it bought back no stock. And by 2000, it had the largest cash balance in the world. So by 2002, in fact, the cash balance was $43 billion. How did it get that? By holding back cash. And I'll tell you, in 2003, I remember looking at news stories to see if anybody was concerned about it. And nobody was in the least bit concerned. You're saying, how come? If they're accumulating this much in cash, why weren't stockholders more pissed off? Why weren't they demanding more cash back? What do you think the reason for that was? So in 2003, when you looked at Microsoft, there was very little pressure to return cash. How would you explain the fact that there was very little pressure? Well, Eric said stock returns, and he's absolutely right. Microsoft went public in 1986, small growth company going public. By 2003, it was the largest market cap company in the world at that point in time. Nobody at Microsoft was complaining about how badly their stock had done, how bad the projects were. This was a company with a track record of great projects, great investments, and great stock returns. You know what? They'd earned the right to accumulate cash. But to show you how fleeting this trust is, a year later, Microsoft announced the largest special dividend in history. It paid a $33 billion dividend in 2004. So in 1 year, you've gone from a company accumulating cash to paying the largest dividend. So what changed? What happened in 2004 that explained the big cash return, the big special dividend? 12 months, everything seemed to change. First, let me give you a clue. Remember that tax law change we talked about? This is the first Bush tax reform. For the first time in history, dividends and buybacks were taxed at the same. So the first thing that happened was the tax law and dividends change. The second was Microsoft started to have trouble. Not so much with its products, but with the Justice Department. Most of you are too young to remember, but 2003 was when the Justice Department started putting pressure on Microsoft, which they viewed as an unstoppable monopoly, to break it up into its operating system, the Windows being one company, and Office and would be another company. So they were pushing for it. The push actually did not get very far because Microsoft stayed intact as a company. First time investors looked at Microsoft, maybe this company will have to think about returning cash. All I'm saying is, when you see, I'm going to stop my video and basically just stay with the slides because you'd still be able to see the slides and maybe the audio will get better. So in 2004, what happened in my view was that investors start to worry about a company, and when you start to worry about a company, you'll start to see pressure build up on the company to return cash. I remember when Apple paid its first dividend in 2012, and people said, what happened? I mean, how can the greatest, I mean, remember the previous decade was Apple's decade, right? It went from 2001, a $4 billion market cap in 2001, to becoming a $600 billion company 10 years later. And this was Steve Jobs' company. You're saying, why in 2012 would Apple start to pay dividends? The reason I think is very simple. In 2011, of course, Steve Jobs, he had to pass on, and you had Tim Cook come in. People didn't have trust in Tim Cook yet. And I think one of the reasons Apple came under pressure to start paying dividends was, again, like Microsoft, you saw the trust was shaken. So what I'm trying to emphasize is when you talk about dividend policy, it's about trust. So when you look at your company, one of the questions we need to look at is how much trust do investors have in my company? So ready? We're going to play. I'm going to play the role of the CEO of a company. And I'm going to list the company. I'm going to tell you what my numbers look like. You're going to have a very easy job to do. You're going to be stockholders in my company. And you're going to tell me whether you trust me with my dividend policy. There's no right or wrong answer. It's about coming from your gut, right? So first thing I'm going to do is described to you Disney as it existed in 2003. Here's what Disney looked like in 2003. Between 94 and 2003, Disney generated $969 million in free cash flows to equity each year on average, $969 million. Between 94 and 2003, Disney paid out about $639 million in dividends and stock buybacks. So it could have paid out $969 million. It paid out $639 million. If I paused right there, I've already told you how much Disney's accumulating in cash, right? $330 million a year, every year for 10 years. 330 times 10 is 3.3 billion. You add interest on top of that, and the cash balance they came up with, not surprisingly, by the end of 2003, Disney had accumulated about $4 billion in cash. So you ready? We have accumulated cash, I've held back cash. You're my stockholders. I'm your CEO. Do you remember who Disney CEO was in 2003? a guy called Michael Eisner. And remember how Eisner treated you guys? You're the stockholders, right? When Disney was doing well, he treated you like dirt, right? He said, no, basically he was an imperial CEO. Remember that board of directors he built up? So keep that in mind, because a CEO's history is going to start to matter now. So I get up in front of you, I'm Michael Eisner, and say, look, I'm not at a good decade. Disney's return on equity in the last 10 years has been 2% less than its cost of equity. It's a very rough measure, but over the last 10 years, I've not taken very good profits. Oh, by the way, Disney's stock has also not done very well. Its Jensen's Alpha is about 3%, minus 3%. So I've taken bad projects. My stock has not done very well. And it's all much of this underperformance can be traced to a decision I being Eisner, made in 1996 to buy Cap Cities ABC. So I have a history with you, right? I've accumulated your cash. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you trust me with your cash? What do you think? I've shown you my track record. I showed you that I did this with a big acquisition. Hey, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not assuming that there'll be a unanimous judgment, but I don't blame you for not trusting me. And the fact that I'm Michael Eisner just makes this worse, right? Because the way I've treated you in the good times is I essentially did not listen to you. I did whatever I wanted. Now do you see why a company's a CEO's history can come back to haunt that CEO? In good times, you can get away being imperial, doing whatever you want. But then there will be bad times. And when you go to Stockholm and say, hey, trust me, they're going to say, why should I trust you? So Disney in 2003 came under incredible pressure to return cash. And I don't blame the stockholders. And of course, if you remember the history of Disney, in 2005, Eisner got pushed out of Disney. Eisner got pushed out and replaced with Bob Iger. And in 2003, as I said, you know, Disney's pushed for acquisitions, and you know, so there was a lot of pressure to pay more in dividends. But by 2009, Bob Iger was now the CEO. So Iger has now become the CEO. The company has shifted from taking bad projects to good projects. Its return on capital and return on equity are now higher than the cost of equity or capital. The Jensen's Alpha has turned positive. And I've started returning more cash than I have available as dividends. Why? Because you didn't trust me before. The only way I could keep you happy was by returning more cash. So now it's 2009. You ready? You're my stockholders again. You're Disney stockholders. And I'm Bob Iger. I get up and say, look, guys, I've been giving you back more cash than I can afford. But Disney has great plans for the future. We'd like to build new theme parks in China. We'd like to expand ESPN. Remember in 2009, ESPN was this great cash cow. And we need to hold back some cash. We'd like to return less cash and ask you for permission, which is the right thing to do, right? It's your cash. Would I be on stronger ground now than Iger was in 2003? I think so. See, what I'm trying to argue here is when CEOs get up and argue for, hey, we'd like to hold back cash, your position is strengthened if you make that argument from having good returns, taking good projects, delivering. So when you're doing well, it's much easier to go out in front of stockholders and argue that you should preserve their cash. If you're doing bad and you get up and say, can I keep your cash? Don't be surprised if stockholders say, not in this lifetime. So let's go final twist. Let's say it's 2013. Iger's still CEO. And dividends and buybacks are now being, again, so they've dropped back to less than free cash flow equity. I'm accumulating cash again. But my corporate governance has become a little shaky. Remember, this was after I told you I was going to leave, and then I changed my mind and I had to stay on. It still is earning a return on capital well above the cost of capital. So I still am in a position of strength, but you don't trust me as much as you did 5 years ago. So now, again, I ask you the same question. I still could potentially get away with withholding cash, but you're a little more doubtful about the cash. Again, same company, three different points in time. 2003, terribly weak position. Stockholders would have demanded the cash back. 2009, much stronger position. You like me, you trust me, I'm doing well. You let me keep the cash. 2013, I'm still doing well, but you don't trust me as much. You can already see how dividend policy can teeter as CEOs become more entrenched and I start worrying about your ego driving your decisions. I haven't done an update, but let's say it's 2018. And I said, do you trust me? What did Disney do in 2017 that might have shaken your trust? This was an Iger decision. He was very proud of it. What did Disney do in 2017? They acquired Fox, right? Or News Corp, or whatever they decide to call it, for $74 billion. Whenever you see a big acquisition by a CEO, you know what the CEO is doing? He's gambling. He's taking all his chips and putting it on one number and say, if this acquisition pays off, I've got freedom for life. Freedom to do what? Do whatever I want. But if this acquisition doesn't pay off, God help me. Because you've, in a sense, taken, because that's what Eisner did in 96. He took all his chips, put it on CapCities, ABC, didn't work out. It ruined his the rest of his tenure as Disney CEO. Maybe this is the reason Iger decided to step down, doesn't have to live with the full consequences of his Fox acquisition. But I think when you see CEOs do big acquisitions, this is the worry you face, is if it doesn't work out, you've lost the freedom to set dividend policy essentially for the rest of your tenure. Any questions before we move on? Okay, so let's move to a second company. Now I'm the CEO of Vale. You ready? Switch hats. You're now going to be shareholders in Vale. And I'm going to show you the numbers, and they're in a sense shocking. Let me explain why they're shocking. I've computed free cash flow to equity, and this is an aggregate between 2008 and 2012, just like for Disney. The free cash flow to equity pre-debt is minus 3.1 billion. The free cash flow to equity after debt is minus 1.3 billion. Let me pause right there. When you have negative free cash flow to equity, how much should you be returning to shareholders? Nothing, right? Here's what they've actually managed to do. They've actually returned. Now, if you gave them the luxury of use a target debt ratio, which is a very luxurious number, 13.3 billion, they actually returned 29.6 billion. No matter what definition of free cash flow equity you're given, Vale is returning a lot more in cash than they can afford to. So you ready? I am Vale's CEO. You're my shareholders.
Question.
Go ahead, Barry.
What's the difference? Like, what is free cash flow to equity pre-debt and post-debt?
Pre-debt is net income minus net capex minus change in working capital. So I stop right there. So that's pre-debt. Post-debt, okay.
How is it free cash flow to equity?
I'm sorry?
How is it free cash flow to equity?
Because I start with net income. Basically, I start with equity income, but then I say, if I did not use any debt this year, if I stopped with net, you know, the numbers I have with just equity-driven earnings, what do I have? This is a number that Warren Buffett calls owner's earnings. Basically, he says, I want to count on debt for my dividends. I'm going to just count on just equity. So it's a very conservative estimate of free cash flow to equity because you're not covering any of your reinvestment from debt. It's coming entirely out of equity.
Understood.
The actual debt is debt repaid minus debt, minus the debt issued. So basically, you take the actual debt. The target debt ratio is, remember we came up with a 50% debt ratio for Vale based on what they can borrow? Is if they borrowed that much debt, that's what the free cash flow equity would be. So three measures of free cash flow equity depending on how you define debt.
Understood. Thanks.
So now be Vale shareholders. I'm Vale CEO. I say, guys, when I say guys, don't take it as sexist. I mean, generally shareholders. So no, I'd like to cut dividends because I'm paying too much. Now we all agree they're paying too much in dividends, right? That seems like a pretty logical thing to ask for. Now your first reaction is actually say yes. But before you say yes, I'm going to remind you of something I talked about at the very start of this class. Remember I said like most Brazilian companies, Vale has two classes of shares. It has common shares and preferred shares. But in Brazil, preferred shares are just common shares without voting rights. Guess which class you own? You own the preferred shares. And on the preferred shares, in return for not giving you voting rights, what did I promise to do? I promised to pay a fixed dividend. Vale's problem comes from the fact that on those preferred shares, they've agreed to pay 35% of earnings as dividends no matter what. And if they fail to pay those dividends, you as preferred shareholders get voting rights. You see why Vale is caught between a rock and a hard place here? If they don't want to give up control, they've got to keep paying dividends. But if they cut dividends, they give up control. So remember, your shareholders, you're the preferred shareholder in the company. And I want to cut dividends. What would you like in return? What are you going to demand in return? Seems like a pretty logical thing to demand. Anybody?
Normal, the stocks with the voting rights?
You're going to demand voting rights in the shares. And that's exactly what Vale shareholders demanded. You know what Vale's response was? No. We'd rather go bankrupt and give up our cash flows and give up control. And I see this play out in companies around the world. Family-controlled companies, for instance, which are over-levered. And they go to the bank to borrow money. And they say, why are you borrowing money? You can't afford more debt. Why don't you issue shares? You know what the response is? If you issue shares, we're going to give up control. I've seen startup founders refuse to go raise equity from venture capitalists and rather borrow money from a bank. You ask them why? Because I don't want to give up control. The play between control and having a healthy company can sometimes lead people to pick control. And the case of Vale, this is exactly the problem they ran into. In fact, Petrobras almost drove itself to bankruptcy by continuing to pay dividends while it's not only did its cash flows to equity turn negative, but its net income turned negative. So this issue of control versus do I want to be a healthy company can play out in company after company. Darshan?
Does ExxonMobil also have a similar problem? This also continues.
See, in defense of ExxonMobil, do you think oil prices will stay at $20 a barrel?
Or $20? No.
They cannot, right? Because in a sense, at $26 a barrel, it's almost impossible for any company except one, Aramco, to make money. So ExxonMobil's managers probably expect oil prices to go back up, whether it goes to 40 or 45. And you know what? They do have a cash balance, at least in the near term, to pay dividends. You know where this would be an issue? Occidental. If Occidental pays dividends, I'm going to say, what's wrong with you guys? If a shale oil company pays dividends, much more of an issue. ExxonMobil, I'll cut them some slack for the moment. But remember we talked about flexible dividends? If you are devising a dividend policy for an oil company, given that oil prices go up and this problem seems to recur every few years, could you figure out a way to structure dividends so they don't have to revisit this policy every time oil prices drop? What would you do if you were a sensible oil company? Ruksha? You might have a different question, but go ahead anyway.
Yeah, I had a question, but I don't have an answer for your question.
But go ahead and take your question. Let people think about the answer of how an oil company should structure its dividends so it doesn't have to worry about oil prices as much. What's your question?
I was wondering, so in the kind of discussion with managers where they're, you know, asking shareholders to accept a cut dividend, yeah, couldn't the management take the hit to the share price and just announce a dividend cut?
Yeah, they could. And in a sense, in desperation, that's what companies will ultimately end up doing. But in a sense, whether you like, I mean, the board of directors decides dividends. Shareholders don't get to vote on it anyway, right? So this is almost implicit rather than explicit, right? Because as a shareholder, you never get a vote on dividends, your board of directors does. And if you really wanted as a manager to get your board of directors to go along, you would. But then you have to, you're getting in front of markets and you're begging them to accept this cut in dividends as a healthy thing. So this is not done even explicitly, it's often implicit. So I've structured it this way to see if US shareholders will go along with the argument that managers are making about cutting dividends.
Okay, understood.
Emily?
Yeah, I have a question about what type of investors would have the bargaining power to request the voting rights in exchange of not having dividends?
Any investor who actually has enough power to get somebody on the board of directors. will be able to argue for it. That's why when a call ICANN says, I want more in cash, what does he back it up with? What do activist investors try to do after they've demanded higher dividends or more buybacks? They start proxy fights. You know what a proxy fight is? Basically, they then go out and they say, look, I'm going to try to get my directors on the board. So they have the power. It's not just that they own a lot of shares, but they bring a lot of shareholders with them. So the types of shareholders are most likely to put pressure on managers are not necessarily shareholders who own a lot of stock, the Fidelities and the BlackRocks. It's the activist investors who, if they make a lot of noise, are likely to get other shareholders to go along.
Thank you.
Anybody have any ideas on, I've always wondered why oil companies don't structure dividends as well, but do you have any ideas? Go ahead.
We wrote in the chat.
Oh, switch to Darshan says, pay buybacks. That's actually good. But is there a way with regular dividends, you could potentially create some flexibility?
Could you link it with, for every share, you get the price of 0.2 gallons of share of oil?
You can link it to the oil price. It's actually, you set it up front. So it's actually clear. Do it when oil prices are high rather than oil prices are low. So it doesn't look like a desperation move. So wait till oil prices get to $60, $70, $80. Pay a big dividend, but say, look, this is the dividend between $60 to $80 oil prices. This is the dividend, and the way you would structure it is you compute the free cash flow equity at different oil prices and see what you can afford to. In a sense, then, there's no signaling left, right? So this way, your dividends automatically change when your oil prices change. Maybe you will get a different class of investors buying your shares, but I think it'd be much healthier for commodity companies if dividends were linked to commodity prices. It's very similar to the argument we made about debt, but in this case, it's actually much easier to do. You don't have to link interest payments. It's not a contractual, it's just essentially a preset commitment that links dividends to oil prices. So let that kind of rattle around, because it hasn't happened in sufficient quantity. As BP talked about doing this a few years ago, but they never carried it to fruition. But I think it makes sense for many oil companies, many commodity companies, to think about at least linking dividends to what the price should be. Okay. So buybacks are one option. The other is linking it to oil prices. Go ahead.
Professor, just on that, I mean, if we're sort of making that assumption kind of ceteris paribus, right? So we're making assumption that there's a knock-on effect to the rest of the capital structure, but in theory, that would, I suspect that would reduce the share price, and then you'd have kind of capital costs elsewhere.
Do companies paying no dividends sell at lower prices than companies that pay big dividends?
Is that because they pay no dividends, or is that because they've sort of moved into a mature territory, the growth is off the...
No, but because remember, over time, you might actually pay the same amount of dividends as another oil company, right? And here's how it works. When oil prices go to $100 a barrel, you'll actually be paying a lot more in dividends than those oil companies that are fixed dividends. So I'm not saying you're going to pay less dividends over time. It's just your dividends will kind of go up and down with oil prices. You get a different investor in your company. So your clientele, there might be a clientele effect, and there might be a cost to you when that happens. But I don't think you're going to find any trouble getting investors in your company with a different kind of dividend policy. It's just that you pay the same amount of dividends over time, but those dividends move up and down with oil prices.
Professor, with this type of structure, could you also put a floor price on the commodity? So if oil, for example, drops below a certain dollar amount per barrel, you wouldn't pay at all?
Absolutely. Don't you think that makes sense? And imagine how many shale oil companies, that pay dividends and wish they'd done this when oil prices were $100 a barrel? ExxonMobil problem. I think that there are ways you can structure, and I've always wondered why people haven't been, or companies haven't been more creative with regular dividends, because that's what's given the opening to buybacks, right? Because people are so stuck on the old type dividends, fix a dividend, you got it stuck with it through time, that buybacks have become such a big part of the process. I'll make a prediction. If this crisis leads to restrictions on buybacks, I'll make a prediction you're going to see much more flexible dividend policies adopted companies, because that's a healthy thing to do.
Is there any way to find out like how many industry, how many investors are looking for like regular dividends in your stock with the intention of just holding it for dividends, and how many are like trading for oil prices somewhere?
You get a very rough estimate across the market, right? Take the market caps of all companies that pay no dividends or very low dividends, and take the market caps of companies that pay big dividends. You know, as I look at what tech companies have done over the last 12 years, my gut feeling is there are a lot more investors today in the game for the capital gains than for old-fashioned dividends. And a very rough estimate would be just take the market caps of, you know, just take the S&P 500, take the market caps of all of the S&P 500 companies that pay no dividends and compare them to the market caps of companies that pay dividends. I think it's about 6-1, 7-1 now. There are plenty of investors out there who are okay with no dividends. But in a sense, if you ask me, you know, will it cost me nothing? In the short term, you will pay a price, because your existing investor base might be those people who like big dividends. So it'll take time for them to adjust. But that adjustment will happen, and then you get a new investor base that's a healthier base for you.
Hi, Professor. I was thinking one of the ways could be that you pay a consistent smaller dividend, and if oil price goes up above a certain level, you pay a bigger special dividend occasionally.
Yeah, you could do that. Okay. So that's in a sense a variation of the same theme, right? You either do buybacks or special dividends that are linked to the oil price, and you pay a base dividend.
Yeah, okay.
But why not make the base dividend zero? The only difference between what you're suggesting and what I'm suggesting is my suggestion, base dividends might be zero, but you know, it might be better to actually structure where there's some base dividend. So I'm willing to live with lots of variations in this on the theme, but we should be asking that question about why isn't there more flexibility built into dividends? So now let's, any other questions? Zane asked a question about, are there regulatory restrictions on how dividends are structured? Absolutely not. You know what the constraints usually are? From banks that you might borrow money from them. It's not from the government, it's from borrowers. But actually, I'm glad you brought up the issue of should governments have regulations on dividends. So let me ask you a question. Let's assume that the government decides to mandate a minimum dividend payout for all companies. Okay? So let's say I pass a law that says every company that makes money should pay out 40% of its earnings as dividends. Given our earlier discussion of free cash flow equity, I want to ask a question about what types of companies will be hurt the most by this mandate. And I'll list out a few, and you tell me whether these are the companies that are made. Go ahead.
D, high growth companies which are making money.
And tell me why. First, let's tell me why money losing companies are not affected.
Because their return on equity is lesser than the cost of equity. So every dollar that they repay is going to be good enough.
And also the mandate is about profits, right? So if you're making money, the mandate doesn't hit. If you're losing money, the mandate doesn't even hit you. So if you're a money-making high-growth company, you see why this will hurt you? You have earnings, but what do your free cash flows to equity look like? If you're a high-growth company, there are a lot of reinvestments. So you could be making money, but your free cash flows to equity are negative, right? So what's the government requiring you to do? Pay a 40% dividend. You just got into a deeper hole. So when you see mandated dividend payouts, guess who pushes for those mandates? Large, mature companies making big profits. You know why? Because it wipes out their competition. I mean, so you get crocodile tears from these big companies saying, oh, this is terrible, government has a mandate. But guess what? They love these dividend mandates, because with these dividend mandates, what you're doing is you're pushing your young growth competition into the ground. So it's a terrible idea to mandate dividend payout. What if the government goes the opposite direction and puts a cap on dividends and buybacks and says, look, every company should reinvest 60% of its earnings back into the company? There are variations. I've heard this actually talked about by politicians on both sides of the spectrum, that we should be requiring US companies to reinvest more, and therefore we should make it a mandate that you cannot return more than 40% of your earnings and dividends. Is that a good idea to mandate reinvestment? Nathan, I'll play the political, because this is actually, a lot of politicians are suggesting this. Yeah?
Okay.
Go ahead, Nathan.
Yeah, so if you're not able to freely return the money as dividends, then the company is going to be looking for other ways to spend it. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of good projects, they'll probably reason backwards that and have some other criteria to start justifying worse and worse projects on an individual basis.
In fact, the easiest way to illustrate this is over the last 12 years, let's assume that airlines had been banned from returning cash. Or couldn't have returned more than 30% of their earnings in cash. And they've been required to reinvest more in new aircraft and new gates or whatever. You know how much deeper our problem would have been now? I mean, these airlines would have so much money on the ground tied up in bad investments. We'd be bailing them out with 10 times more money. I think it's a terrible idea, I'll be quite honest, for governments to mandate either fixed dividends or fixed reinvestment. You know, I know this is a very laissez-faire approach and you're saying this is capital. You know what? I think that if you force companies to reinvest money, you're destroying any chances of change in your economy. Because your weakest, your worst companies will be reinvesting your money instead of your, you know, potentially disruptive new companies that actually can change your economy. So I know it's kind of a controversial point of view now because, you know, for whatever reason, it's considered virtuous to invest and terrible to return cash. But I think that's a terrible attitude to take because there are many companies that shouldn't be returning cash. So Rukshan, you have a hand up. Do you have another comment question or is it from before?
No, that's from before. I'll take it down.
So think about that, about dividend mandates, because it is going to be part of the political campaign this year, I think, is you're going to see talk about should we require companies to reinvest more, because this crisis is creating a lot of bad ideas that could very well become policy and law in the next year or two. And this is one of those things that's going to bubble up. It's let's ban buybacks, which I'm okay with if you're willing to shift to flexible dividends. But furthermore, there are people argue that let's ban companies from returning cash and force them to reinvest money, which I think is a terrible idea. Let me move on to the third case. Yeah, let's talk about British Petroleum in 1992. 1992, I actually did a session for BP it was actually one of the most interesting sessions I did, where they flew in 20 of their brightest, you know, oil. See, these were actually engineers and scientists. They flew them into London and they said, can you teach them enough corporate finance that they can deal with the, you know, with financial decisions? We want to move them up the organization. I said, sure. So I did a 2-day compressed corporate finance class for BP engineers. And you know what? Some of the easiest groups I ever worked with. These guys were great with numbers. And after the 2 days, they said, this is all there is in corporate finance. And we were terrified of this. So one of the things I did as part of the analysis was I took BP through the process. That's because they knew the company, they could see what the numbers were, they could relate much better. So I got to the dividend section and I thought I'd screwed up when I looked at the numbers. Because here's what I saw in the 10 years between 1982 and 91. The average free cash flow equity at BP was about $571 million. If I paused right there and asked you how much cash could BP have returned, the answer is about $571 million, right? But they actually returned about $1.5 billion every year in pure dividends. There were no buybacks, it was all dividends. So here's a company that could have returned $571 million in dividends, has been returning $1.5 billion in free cash flow equity year after year after year for 10 years. This company clearly has a dividend problem, right? And in the process, you think, how did they come up with $1.5 billion to return every year? They went out and borrowed $1 billion every year, not to take new projects, not to invest in new oil wells, but to continue to pay these dividends. So we all agree that BP has a dividend problem. It's paying too much in dividends. Now here's my question. BP, everybody knew they had a dividend problem. They knew it in 1987, 88, 89. So how do you explain the fact that this company with a significant dividend problem, everybody knows, even the janitor at BP knew there was a dividend problem. You know why? Because when he asked for a new broom or a vacuum, the answer was, we can't get a new vacuum. We need every pound in cash available to be paid out as dividends. So my question is a very simple one. Why would a company that knows it has a dividend problem not deal with that problem? What do you think held them back? If you're an oil company, what do you keep hoping for? That something good will happen. And for an oil company, you know what that was? They kept hoping that oil prices would rise. Maybe next year, maybe next year. You see, that's not rational. Why don't they just cut the dividends? Remember we talked about clientels? They were terrified. BP by 1992 was paying such a big dividend that it was attracting every dividend addict in the world to its investor base. So what are you going to do? You're going to get in front of dividend addicts and say, I'm going to cut off your drug. You know what's going to happen to you? You're not going to make it out of that meeting alive. Every year they thought about cutting dividends, but they were so terrified of what would happen that they kept putting it off. Finally, in 1992, they cut dividends. You see, finally, somebody had the good sense to do it. You know why they had to cut dividends? Where did I say they got the $1 billion in dividends every year for the previous 10 years? Because they went out and borrowed money. Well, finally, in 1992, the bank said, no more. You are already the most highly levered oil company in the world. They refused to lend them the money. So they finally did the right thing. And to show you there's no justice in the world, look at this news story that came out right after they cut dividends. BP shares plummet after dividend is slashed. You see, first you're saying, why? They're doing this right thing. Hey, remember what I said about dividend addicts? All they care about is dividends. The minute you slash dividends, they're heading for the exit door. I'll tell you the full story here. In about 2 months, the share price had come back to what it was after the dividend was slashed. It was the healthiest thing that BP could have done in hindsight. But here was the price that was paid. Remember those managers in charge when they cut dividends? Those managers were pushed out of their jobs. And I think they deserved it. Why? Because they were the managers for the previous 10 years. The problem with BP was not that they cut dividends, but they waited too long. If you have a dividend problem, you need to deal with it quickly, because the longer you put it off, the worse it's going to get. Many oil companies, I'm not talking about just ExxonMobil, many oil companies will have to face this question. And if oil prices stay low, I would recommend that oil companies jump early and cut dividends, take their punishment. Because if they put it off, I think the pain is only going to get worse. Now, Sam asked, why did investors see a dividend slash coming? Do dividend addicts, are they rational people? I mean, any addict is not a rational person. Dividend addicts are not rational. They think the company will keep paying dividends no matter what. It's not just oil companies. I'll tell you, lots of banks now have dividends they can't sustain. Especially if you're a bank that's overexposed to airlines or to oil because you've lent a lot of money. My recommendation is cut the dividends now. Take your punishment now and move on, because if you wait, the pain will only get larger. Any questions? Now, this is part actually of a broader question, which is if you want to cut dividends for good reasons, you think, what good reasons can there be? Let's say you're a company that has great growth investments that has popped up. Remember the telecom example I talked about? The business has changed, there are good investments that have popped up, and you want to cut dividends. Is there a way you can frame your dividends in a way that investors will be more likely to accept the cut in dividends? Because remember, these investors, their first reaction is going to be negative. In fact, what I've done here is actually looked at cuts in dividends where that cut in dividends is accompanied by a drop in earnings. So these are companies that say our earnings dropped, and by the way, we're also cutting dividends. The stock price drops about 7% in the quarter prior to the dividend cut, about 8% in the announcement period. But in the quarter after, it kind of bounces back. So this is a simultaneous announcement. If you had a prior announcement of an earnings decline, which was, you know, a quarter ago, 2 years ago, then the prior quarter, the stock price is down 7.6%. The announcement, it's down 5.5%. But the quarter after, maybe you get a little bounce back. But if you get a dividend cut where earnings have not dropped, but you also simultaneously announce investments you're going to make, a project you're going to take, a business you're going to expand, the stock price still drops on the announcement, but it bounces back much more in the quarter after. And I know that it is a very confusing table to read, but the way to read it is no matter how you frame your dividend cut, the first reaction is almost always going to be negative. Why? Because people don't trust you right away. But if you can show that the dividends are being cut, not for bad reasons, your earnings have collapsed, because you're taking good projects, you're much more likely to see a bounce back in your stock price as people start to recognize it. And new stockholders maybe come into your company. Your stockholder base shifts over time, and that's what you see reflected. Parent?
How much of this is the fact that the investors who exit are usually like retail investors who are not very price sensitive, and mostly when you make smarter moves like dividend cuts, the buyers have access to algorithmic trading, and they only buy it very like. Only if the impact.
Perry, let me contest the notion that retail investors are naive and stupid and institutional investors are smart. In my experience, when you see a crisis and you see panic selling, who sells? Who do you think is more likely to be panic selling? Institutions or retail
institutions.
Investors? Institutions. I actually, in my experience, find that institutions are more sheepish than retail investors are. Sheepish in what sense? They look at a crowd and they join in, they're pricers. So I don't think it's so much your investor base. I think it's just a different kind of investor that you're attracting. So even among institutional investors, there are institutional investors who are dividend addicts and institutional investors who basically are capital gains investors. You just get a different type of investor in your company. And that's healthy for you as a company. If you really have good investments, you don't want dividend addicts in your company. This is a way in which you can restructure your investor base to attract a new type of investor.
Wonderful.
So any other questions about BP? Yeah. Sam, you said maybe management's looking at the announcement period performance and fearing the job. They should. I mean, in a sense, that's what I think makes companies so reluctant to act quickly. Because when you cut dividends, what investors do is almost always going to be negative and you worry about consequences. But then you'd expect dividend cuts to be more common in countries with weak corporate governance, right? So if you're an oil company in Latin America where the stockholders have very little power, you should be more likely to cut dividends. And you don't see it there as well. There's something deeper here, right? Now, Sam, can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, I'm unmuted. I was interested in the question you asked, Perry, about whether you think retail or institutional are more likely to panic sell. And my background is in wealth management, and I was kind of beaten over the head with this one graph that showed the average return for retail investors. And maybe I need to just present that, but my question is in the context of the average return for retail investors and whether that
maybe you were looking at a graph of traders, because day traders are the only ones where I know the returns can be that low. You know why they're that low? Because the transactions cost kill you. I've seen studies of individual retail investors, and they actually do better than the average mutual fund.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
In terms of Jensen's alpha. But if you trade a lot, and we know that with certainty, the more you trade, the worse your returns become. And if you're a day trader, I've never understood, you know, why would, you know, again, I don't want to insult you. If you're a day trader in your previous life, I
think. No, we just curious.
So if there are no other questions, Sam, if you could unmute yourself. David, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, quick question on free cash flow to equity. I think you may have mentioned this, so apologies, but why wouldn't the free cash flow to equity in the BP case include the money that they're borrowing to pay the dividend?
Yeah, that's a good question. If I included the new debt, I actually used the debt ratio of oil companies, and if I included the debt, then the free cash and equity would always match up to what
okay.
I paid them. So you're right. I was trying to figure out how much they were borrowing over and above their debt capacity to get to the dividends. And that was $1 billion every year. And that's how they ended up over levered in the first place.
Got it. Thank you.
So let's move on to case four. This was the limited in 1993. For those of you who remember the limited, are they still around? I guess they are. They're a retail company. But this was in their glory days when the Gap and the limited were growth companies. There was a day when that was true. So in 1993, I looked at the limited. Their free cash flow to equity in the previous 10 years had been minus 34.2 million a year. Why? They were growing fast. They were making money, but they were opening new stores, reinvesting a lot. Their dividends were 41 million a year. Already you can say, why would you do this? You're a growth company, you're earning more than your cost of equity. Why would you pay dividends if you're a growth company with negative free cash flow equity? So I'm going to frame, and I don't know whether this happened, one of the ways in which young growth companies start to pay dividends. And you tell me what might be wrong with this path, because clearly you're going on a path that's going to get you into trouble. You're a young growth company and I'm your investment banker. You don't pay a dividend right now. And I come to you and say, look, if you don't pay a dividend, there are certain investors who cannot buy your stock. And that's true. There are some pension funds that are restricted from buying shares in companies that don't pay dividends. So I say, if you pay a token dividend, you know what a token is, just a little bit of dividends, those people will be able to buy your shares. And now that the demand for your shares has expanded, your share price will go. So clearly you have a negative free cash flow equity. All I'm asking you to do is pay a token dividend. Do you think you should go along and pay a token dividend? What's wrong with this? I think it's wrong, but tell me what's wrong with this argument. Rukshan, why shouldn't I do it? Oh, Sam, I'm going to put Sam on. Sam?
Yeah, well, we had the conversation. We talked about how they're just as interested in the dividend as they are, I mean, the moment you review.
In other words, it's like giving an addict a little bit of cocaine and say, just stop right there. It never works, right? The problem with dividends is you give a little dividends and you let those people in. Guess what they demand a year later? More in dividends. In fact, that's exactly what happened to Limited. They paid $1 billion in dividends, I think, in 1985. By the time you got to 1991, they were paying $101 million in dividends. If you cannot afford to pay dividends, don't even open the door because it's only going to get you into trouble. So if you can't afford to pay dividends, why pay? Why stop? Why open the door? There are enough investors out there who can buy your stock who don't want dividends. Just go with them. Which brings me to my fifth and final case. I looked at Tata Motors. Their free cash flow equity, even with the best case scenarios, you know, you're coming up with 48 billion, but they actually used, you know, because they borrowed so much money, they had $825 million in dividends, in free cash flow equity. They actually returned about 75 million, but mostly because they borrowed a ton of money. Their negative free cash flow equity came largely from acquisitions. Yeah, because during this period, Tata Motors bought Jaguar Land Rover. So they had a negative free cash flow equity from acquisitions. They funded a lot of those acquisitions with debt, but they continued to pay dividends. And remember, they're over-levered. This is where, when you look at dividend policy, my recommendation is also look at what you found earlier with the company in terms of leverage. Tata Motors is already over-levered. They're doing acquisitions. They're continuing to pay dividends. There's a problem here, right? There's a dividend problem because this company is, in a sense, borrowing and getting beyond its target debt capacity. And again, I'm not going to deal too deeply with Tata Motors because I think Tata Motors, the problem is it's part of a family group. I have no idea what's happening in the rest of the family group. And as with capital structure, I think it's very difficult to look at Tata Motors and say, does that dividend policy make sense? Because the family group's need for cash can be driving it. I mean, Tata Motors, let's face it, the Tata Group is using the positive cash flows from TCS in all kinds of interesting ways. Just like Reliance used the free cash flows equity from Reliance Petrochemical to start Jio. Now, in some cases, they will do sensible things. In some cases, they will not. But with weak corporate governance, that's what you always worry about. Is where's the cash going? Is it going into sensible places? But there's nothing you can do to stop a bad management that's set in its ways if you're very weak corporate governance. So dividend policy is where you're going to regret the fact that you do not have any control over the cash being paid out. Any questions on those five companies? So what I'd like you to do is take your company, take that matrix, and again, I'm not asking for precision here. Make a judgment call. Do you trust the managers in your company with cash? Because that's what's going to drive whether you're going to push your company to return more in cash, whether you're going to leave the company alone and say, just accumulate cash, or whether you're going to ask the company to actually return less cash. You know, because in some cases, you might just look at the company and say, look, return less cash. You're just digging a hole for yourself. That's only going to get worse. But there might not be consensus. There might be other shareholders in the company who are so addicted to dividends, they will want this company to keep paying dividends into bankruptcy. So that's basically what the dividend part of your project is. It's looking at the dividends of free cash to equity, then looking at the Jensen's alpha and the return on capital. That's why I asked you to look at those to see, to get a sense of whether you trust the management. And then I'm going to take your perspective on the company. And bring it to the analysis, what you found in the leverage part of the project as well, as to whether the company is under-levered or over-levered. Because if it's under-levered, that might drive you to say, keep paying dividends because I want my equity to decrease as a percentage of the value of the firm. So everything kind of comes together in that final recommendation. So any questions at all about the free cash flow to equity approach and how we're using it? So let's talk about the other way to set dividends. And unfortunately, just as with capital structure, this is the way most companies decide, not just how much to pay in dividends, but whether to buy back stock and how much to buy back. It's a me too approach, where they look at the rest of the sector and they say, what is the rest of the sector doing? Let me stay as close as I can to the rest of the sector. This is how banks end up paying dividends, is because in the bank sector, it's conventional practice for banks to pay dividends. So if you're a bank, even a mature bank, you feel a lot of pressure to pay dividends. In contrast, if you're a tech company, mature tech companies don't pay much in dividends. You can get away paying low dividends, but you might have to buy back stock in today's day and age. So this table below here, here's what I've done, is I've taken my five companies, the dividend yield payout based 2013 number average, and I've compared it to the sector. Don't read too much into it, but there is some symmetry, right? Disney's dividend payout ratio looks a lot like the sector. Vale is paying out a lot in dividends, but so is the rest of the sector. Deutsche is paying out a huge amount of dividends if you look at 2013, but relative to the sector, their argument is payout ratio is not that bad. But you can see that in what the rest of the sector does plays out. And one reason Baidu can get away returning no cash is it's in a sector where most companies don't return much in cash. So So look at the dividend yield and the payout ratio of other companies in the sector. And a closer look at Disney's peer group, here's what I see. I see dividend yields and payout ratios. And you can see the numbers are all over. I can get an average number, but there are some companies that pay no dividends. In fact, a lot of companies pay no dividends, and the payout ratio reflects the same phenomenon. The cash return, all I'm doing is I'm counting buybacks as well. So these are all numbers that you can pull off Capital IQ for other companies in your sector. So you can compare what your company is doing relative to the rest of the sector. So sometimes companies do irrational things with dividend policy, but their defense is, hey, look, the rest of the sector is doing it too. One final thing I did here is I took, just like with debt ratios, I looked at dividend yields and payout ratios for US companies. This is the January 2014 regression, but I'll send you the link to the 2020 regression. What is it going to tell me? It tells me what companies are doing across the entire market. And in this regression, the R squares are actually not bad, much better than they were with the capital structure. I've run a regression across the entire market. The numbers in brackets below are my T statistics. That's from the regression. And both these regressions are statistically significant. You're saying, how am I going to use these regressions? These are the regressions across the entire market. I've regressed the payout and the yield against betas, arguing that higher beta companies should have lower dividends. Growth, higher growth companies should have lower dividends. And debt ratios, arguing that companies with more debt are more likely to be able to pay out dividends because they can afford to pay out more dividends, because more of that reinvestment is covered with debt. I took Disney's numbers and plugged them into the regressions. Okay? Again, this is a me too approach extended to the entire market. If I take Disney's beta, growth rate and debt to cap ratio and plug them into the regressions, here's what I get. Disney should be paying out about 27% of its earnings as dividends, payout ratio, and have a 1.4% dividend yield. It actually is paying out about 1.09%, and its payout ratio is 22%. Now, statistically, those are probably pretty close to my predictions, but if I wanted to make an issue of the difference, I could make the argument as Disney that I'm paying out 2 billion dividends. But what I'm missing when I say that is all of those payouts. So when you look at the rest of the sector, look at dividend yields and payout ratios, but also check buybacks. Maybe your sector is one of those that shifted increasingly towards buybacks, and that can explain why your company is buying back as much as it can. Before I leave the section, I know I'm planning to write a post on buybacks, and I'm going to argue that there are companies that have adopted unhealthy buyback policies. What are these companies doing? These are companies that are buying back stock because everybody else is buying back stock. There are good reasons for buybacks and bad reasons for buybacks, just as there are good reasons for dividends and bad reasons for dividends. And I think we should talk about the bad reasons for buybacks and try to stop them rather than say, let's not have buybacks or let's put a law restricting dividends. Because bludgeons almost never work in this. The law of unintended consequences will mean the costs of these policies are always going to be much greater than the benefits. Any final questions on dividends before we leave this section?
So for your peer group, did you apply any other filters apart from just the sector?
I tried to stay, in fact, the peer group I use for both my debt and my dividend policy is, I looked at the companies that my company is most like, because what I'm trying to see is, hey, what are the companies Disney's going to look at when it says, you know, when it sets debt and dividend policy? My guess is probably, my peer group is probably even too big for them. They're probably looking at Viacom and 3 or 4 other big companies, because Disney doesn't want to look at the really small entertainment companies. So what you're trying to do with your initial peer group is say, who does my company compare itself to? If you're a small software company, it might be other small software companies. So unlike in valuations, those of you in my valuation class were asked for large samples and companies that might be very different from yours. Here's, you might want to keep your company smaller and more like your company, because you're trying to think about who does my company, compare itself to when it sets debt policy and dividend policy. Another idea is to look at equity research reports, because one of the companies are very sensitive to is who the equity research analysts compare me to. So actually reverse engineer it and say, let me pick up an equity research report on Disney and see who's in the comparable group. Because guess what? That's who Disney might look at when they say, who should we be, structuring our dividend and debt policy to?
Right. But that approach is different from how we compute for beta.
Yeah. Because there we're trying to do the right thing. Here we're trying to do what's the Me Tooism. So in a sense, you're trying to explain why companies have the policies they do, even if they're stupid policies.
Right.
But wait, on a follow-up, then our recommendation should be the right thing, not the explanation of the stupid thing. So why wouldn't...
Exactly. So you're just, the peer group analysis I do because it'll explain to me why my company might be doing something that doesn't make any sense. Because sometimes in your companies, you look at your company and say, my company is negative free cash plus equity. Why the heck is it paying dividends and buying back stock? The peer group assessment then can explain to you why your company is doing what it is. But it also might feed into how you make recommendations, because you have a much tougher job in a case where the managers say, but we're just doing what everybody else is doing. So it just means that when you make your recommendation, you might have to be more creative about the way you present that recommendation. So an oil company, rather than say, let's cut dividends, you might say, let's tie dividends to oil prices. So it's more for your assessment of how difficult is my sales pitch going to be when I try to get my company to do the right thing.
Yeah. So then the sales pitch should be based on more similar looking comps in terms of market size?
It should bring in what you cannot act like the other companies are not there, right? The CFO is always going to say, but everybody else pays dividends. You then have to explain why you might compute the free cash flow as equity for the other company and show that those companies are more mature, they have positive free cash flow equity, but your company because it's got more reinvestment needs. It's trying to grow faster. It's negative free cash flow equity. So sometimes logic will help you explain why the rest of the peer group is behaving differently from you. That's your strongest case. You know, if that doesn't work, then your case got a lot more difficult because they're going to keep throwing up this defense, but everybody else does it. Why shouldn't I do it? You know? Yeah. And unfortunately, sometimes your best recommendations, so be prepared for frustration there, because you can make the recommendation, the company would still say, no, we're going to keep paying dividends.
Okay, thank you.
Rizwana?
My question was basically around paybacks. If you have positive free cash flow, why would paybacks be viewed very negatively? For dividends, I understand it's a significant.
Let me play devil's advocate. Let's suppose you're a tech company, right? Nobody else pays back. Let's say you're in a sector where nobody pays dividends, nobody buys back stock. Remember the signaling story that was, that, I think you brought this up early on. Remember people just take dividends blindly as a signal? So when you first announce dividends, people say, well, that's a terrible thing to do. You know, are you signaling your growth is lower? You know what? Sometimes it's not wrong to signal the truth. But initially, at least, people will react with shock. They say, I thought you were a growth company. So all I'm saying is, even when it's the right thing to do, don't expect the market to go along with you, because there will be that initial noise to get through. People don't quite know what's going on. So when companies announce dividends for the first time or cut dividends, I advise them to provide investors with the backup, with, you know, trust them with the logic. Say, this is why we're starting to pay dividends. Right now, companies don't do it. They cut dividends and they expect investors to read behind, you know, whatever they've done. So I think being transparent and providing a rationale is a good way to at least buffer that impact. Okay, so let's start on valuation. Obviously, we're not going to get very far, but at least I want to set up the process. Now, I like one of my favorite quotes in valuation is this Oscar Wilde quote that, you know, about a cynic being a person who knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing. In fact, I would use the same description for a trader. You know, traders know the price of everything. Why? Because they have a Bloomberg terminal in front of them, but the value of nothing. Now, a lot of people in markets are traders. They don't know the value of what they're trading in. They trade. There's nothing good or bad about it. It's just different. So I want to talk about value. And why do I want to talk about value if this is not a valuation class? Because the end game in corporate finance is to maximize the value of the business. Somehow we've been able to get through 24 sessions without dealing with that word value. We talked about, hey, do, you know, going to the optimal debt ratio is good because it'll increase your values of firm. I now want to come back and talk about value, because if this is the end game, I've got to tie everything we've talked about so far to value. So let me set the table. There are three ways you can put a number on an asset. One is what I call intrinsic valuation. It sounds fancy, but it's very, very basic, where you put a number on an asset based on its cash flows, its growth and risk. So when you do discounted cash flow valuation, you're estimating intrinsic value. Why? Because you're tying the value to cash flows, growth, and risk. That's the approach I'm going to use for this part, this class at least. But in my valuation class, I also talk about a second way you can put a price on an asset or a number on an asset. You can look at what similar assets are being priced at out there. It's called pricing. It's how we decide how much to pay for a house. It's pricing. So in intrinsic valuation, you put a number on an asset based on its cash flows, growth, and risk. In pricing, you put a number on an asset based on how similar assets are being priced. There's a third way you can put a number on an asset, and it works on a subset of assets. And this is true when you have an asset which has a contingent cash flow. Something has to happen for the asset to pay off. What am I talking about? A biotech firm with a drug working its way through a pipeline. If it gets approved, it could be a blockbuster drug. If it doesn't, it's worth nothing. In fact, it would be a negative cash flow. An oil company with undeveloped oil reserves, which are not viable today. There you have an option, and an option pricing model might work. But it's a very unusual circumstance. In most assets, you can either value the asset or you can price it. And as I said, this class, I want to talk about value. So let me set the table. When you think about discounted cash flow valuation models, you're probably thinking of spreadsheets. And I don't blame you, because that's what valuation has become in a lot of places. Take a big Excel spreadsheet, plug numbers in, and go to the races. But to me, when I think about valuation of a company, I think about four basic inputs that drive value. The first is, what are your existing assets creating as cash flows? I don't know whether you remember, but early in this class, I talked about a financial balance sheet, where I said the value of a business comes from investments it's already made, those are assets in place, as well as growth assets, investments I expect you to make in the future. So when I sit down to value a company, the first thing I look at are what are the existing assets the company has and what are those cash flows? So that's a starting point. The second step in this process, stop and ask, what's the value of future growth? Notice how I phrase that question, not what's your future growth rate. Growth by itself is a mixed blessing, because when I have growth, the good side of growth is my earnings go up, my revenues go up. The bad side of growth is I have to reinvest to create that growth. You see, so what? Sometimes the bad side can exceed the good side. This is why earlier when we talked about dividend policy, we talked about why it doesn't make sense to mandate that every company reinvest. You can grow and destroy value. You can grow and do nothing for value. You can grow and increase value. So the second question I have to confront in intrinsic valuation, it's what's the value of my future growth? Positive, zero, or negative. Third, I have to bring in risk. And in a discounted cash flow model, the only place you show risk is in your discount rate. And finally, because my cash flows can continue to forever, I have to stop at some point in time and put in what I call a steady state. What happens in steady state? Beyond that point in time, my cash flows continue to grow, but they grow at a fixed rate. What does that allow me to do? It allows me to use that perpetual growth model. Remember, we used this for the Disney theme park, Beyond Year 10. I can use that for a company. Ultimately, my discounted cash flow model tries to bring all four components into my final value. So if you think about what drives value, it's all about cash flows and discount rates. And before we delve into the details, I want to step back and talk about two basic ways in which you can approach valuation. The first is you can focus your attention entirely on the equity investors in the company. Remember, there are two ways you can raise funding for a company, right? You can borrow money or you can use equity. In equity valuation, your focus stays entirely on equity investors. And here's what you do. You have blinders. You look at the cash flows that equity investors get from the company. What are those cash flows? Those are cash flows left over after reinvestment, after debt payments, after taxes. That sounds familiar. That's free cash flow to equity, right? So in equity valuation, here's what you do. You project out free cash flows to equity and you discount them back at the cost of equity. And what you get as a present value will be the value of equity in a business. Cash flows to equity discount to the cost of equity. But as we said, free cash flows to equity will require that you make assumptions about net capex and change in working capital and how much will come from debt. And some people are not comfortable doing that. So they use a much lazier definition of free cash flow to equity. They say, just look at the cash flows you get as an equity investor from a company. You say, what are you talking about? If you're an equity investor in a publicly traded company, what's the only cash flow that you can actually see, that you get in your mailbox every 6 months? It's dividends, right? So dividend discount models are a special case of an equity valuation model. Why? Because when you use a dividend discount model, you're just discounting dividends and stopping. You're saying, why should I stop there? Earlier, when we talked about dividend policy, we compared dividends to free cash flow equity. Remember for Microsoft in 97? Paying no dividends. If I used a dividend discount model, I'd show zero in cash flows. But remember that $2.3 billion they could have paid in dividends? Where did that cash go? It went into a cash balance and technically belongs to US stockholders. So think of the dividend discount model as a narrower way of valuing equity and free cash flow equity models as the more general way of valuing equity. But in both cases, you're discounting cash flows to equity at a cost of equity to value the equity in a company. So one way to approach valuation is to wear blinders, focus on cash flows to equity, discount at the cost of equity. Everybody comfortable with that variation in valuation? Focus on equity, cash flows to equity, cost of equity. Okay. So let's talk about cash flows a different way of approaching valuation. Rather than focusing on equity, why don't you focus on both claim holders? You say, what are you talking about? Remember, I raised capital from both equity and debt. My equity investors got cash flows to equity. Did my people who lent money to me, did they also get cash flows in the firm? Absolutely. In the form of interest payments and principal payments. If I look at the collective cash flows that both equity investors and lenders are getting from the firm, that collective cash flow is called cash flow to the firm. It's a pre-debt cash flow. It's cash flows before debt payments. But if those are the cash flows I'm discounting, the discount rate I use should be a weighted average of what my equity investors want, which is the cost of equity, and what my lenders want, which is the cost of debt. That, of course, is the cost of capital. My cash flows to the firm discounted at the cost of capital gives me the value of the entire firm. So the first choice you often have to make when you sit down to do a valuation is you have to decide whether you're going to do an equity valuation or a firm valuation, because every choice you make is going to be driven by that first choice up here. So make a choice. What is the cash flow you're going to discount? Are you going to be lazy and discount just dividends? In which case, your life got very simple. Are you going to take the more general approach and estimate free cash flow to equity after debt cash flows and discount them at the cost of equity? Or are you going to value the entire firm? And I'm going to take you through different paths for my different companies. For Deutsche Bank in 2007, I'm going to just discount dividends. Why? Because these were my days of innocence. Pre-2008, I used to just value banks based on a dividend discount model. I no longer do that, and I'll explain why. Even for Deutsche, later in the 2016, 2013 valuation, you're going to see me shift away from dividends, and you're going to see why. So you're going to see a dividend discount model and a free cash flow equity model. For Tata Motors, where the debt ratio had stayed stable over time, and this makes my free cash flow equity calculation much easier, I'm going to use a free cash flow equity model. Incidentally, the value you get for your equity should be the same, whether you use free cash flow equity models or free cash flow of the firm models, if you do them consistently. So I'm going to go with whatever's easier. For Tata Motors, I'm going to use a free cash flow equity model. And for Vale and Disney, because the debt ratio is shifting over time, I'm going to discount free cash flow of the firm. I'll make your life easier. None of you is valuing a bank or should be valuing a bank. Why? Because when you picked a company, I asked to stay away from financial service. Of course, you might not have listened to me, in which case you need to talk to me about how to value your company. You're valuing a company. My suggestion is you value the entire firm, because I'm going to ask you to do things with the valuation that are easier to do when you do a firm valuation than an equity valuation. Like what? Like change your debt ratio. So you're going to see me do a dividend discount model, a free cash flow equity model, and a free cash flow the firm model. Along the way, I'm going to argue that every time you value a company, you have to think about the story you're telling. You say, but I thought valuation was all about numbers. That's a misconception. For those of you who are in my valuation class now, you know how much I tell stories with my numbers and how much I believe that every valuation has to have a story holding it together. Otherwise, all you have are a collection of numbers. So I'm going to send you a link that I'd like you to read before the next session, because it's going to frame how you should think about valuation. But in the next session, here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at cash flows, discount rates, growth rates to use in valuation, and I have some good news for you. We've already done the dirty work that we need to do for valuation. Like what? We've already estimated the cost of capital for Vale, for Disney. So when I value Vale and Disney, I am going to use the same cost of capital I've estimated for corporate finance. We've already talked about estimating cash flows when we did capital budgeting. I'm going to use exactly the same techniques when I value the firm. If you can do corporate finance, you already have the tools to do valuation. So when we get back on Wednesday, we're going to talk about the specifics of cash flows, discount rates, and growth rates. But try to read the link about stories and numbers that I'm going to send you, because at least it's going to give you some perspective on how to think about those inputs. But that's about it for today. Any final questions before I sign off?
Professor, I have a question. Yes. When we talk about cutting down the dividend and take the pain right now for better growth in long term, but for a market like Australia, where like the top largest cap companies are resources, financial services, telco, which are like companies who used to pay very high dividends. So if they are going to take the approach to a better, you know, like dividends policy, that will be paying for the
market. This was my point with Sam earlier, is if you're in a market or a sector where everybody else has a very different dividend policy than the one you're recommending to your company, it's going to be very difficult to get the company to do the sensible thing. But the bottom line is, if you don't do it, what's going to happen to you? Let's say you decide not to cut dividends because you think it'll be received badly, and you're an undercapitalized bank. We're going to see what happened to Deutsche because they kept paying dividends through 2012. They've driven themselves into a ditch. They've essentially rendered themselves into this bank that could very easily become worthless. So I agree with you. It's a much tougher decision to make, but no. Sometimes you got to do it for the health of the company and for its survival.
But from an investor's point of view, how would you view this market and your choice of companies?
Well, you got to decide whether you'd like to collect dividends for 3 years and have your company go bankrupt, or in which case, what happens to your stock price?
Thank you.
All right, so you got to think through. And that's the problem with dividend addicts, is they can't think through what happens. They want the dividends now and they don't care, or they don't, at least in their mind, care about what will happen in 3 years. Darshan?
I just had a technical, like, logistical question. What is the date when you want the numbers to be updated in your sheet, Google Sheet?
I think that, you know, for some, I would say start wrapping up. Don't wait for anything else if you haven't done it. If you've done it already, then pick that date. And if you pick different dates for different companies in your group, that's okay as well. Just specify the date that you pick for your analysis and just lock it in.
Friday, I mean, what is the due date?
The numbers that you need to send me, I need to get by Sunday. But when you did the numbers, I'm not going to lock you in, right? So if you did the numbers 2 weeks ago, I'm not going to ask you to do everything again over and over again through Friday. If you give me at least the market price on Friday, right? I would like that because I'd like the updated market price. Don't give me the price as of March 15th, but your analysis itself could be dated by 2 weeks, 4 weeks, whenever you did it.
Yeah.
My guess is a lot of people are doing it this week. So if you're doing it Wednesday, Tuesday, get it done and say, don't make it a moving target.
Yeah.
So Professor, if we had, say, taken the risk-free rate and done all our analysis based on, say, what it was in March, do we have to update everything again?
What is the only number you have to update?
Sorry?
The only number you have to update is the risk-free rate. So when you say update it all again,
the risk-free rate, I've done all the calculations. And by now, even the beta and alpha would have changed.
Did you keep the risk-free, have you hard-coded the risk-free rate into your calculations? If you did, then leave it alone. One reason I always try to keep macro numbers, you know what I mean by hardcore, right? You don't enter 2.33% into a cell. You just enter, you know, an input cell that's a risk-free rate. So if you did hardcode it, leave it alone. It's not worth the trouble. If you haven't hardcoded, if it's coming from an input sheet, then it's just changing the risk-free rate in the input sheet. So the lesson that should be learned from this is, if you're building spreadsheets, don't hardcode macro numbers. Keep them separate in an input page. That way you have at least the luxury. Now, I'm not going to penalize you if you hardcoded them. Just keep it as a lesson for the long term. Keep numbers on an input page.
Sure. Thank you.
Sam?
No, that I was just, you said my name, so I thought I was going to have to respond. So.
Okay. That's it. That's it, folks. Thank you very much. And I will see you on Wednesday. Take care.
Thanks.